Filling two stained champagne flutes, she began to eat her supper quite composedly, without speaking. Mallory gazed fixedly at her dimpled arms and shoulders and the swell of her heavy, dark-nippled breasts in the thin chemise, and wondered a bit about the plainness of her face. He drank a glass of the acrid, bad champagne and ate the greenish ham in famished mouthfuls. Hetty finished the sausages. Then, with a crooked smile, she slid out of bed and squatted by its side, hoisting the chemise to her waist.
"That champagne runs right through you, don't it? I need the pot. Don't look unless you want to."
Mallory looked aside politely and listened to the rattle of piss.
"Let's wash," she said. "I'll fetch a basin."
She came back with an enamelled pan of reeking London water and sponged at herself with a loofah.
"Your form is splendid," Mallory said.
Her hands and feet were small, but the columnar roundness of her calves and thighs were marvels of mammalian anatomy. Her great solid buttocks were faultless. They seemed weirdly familiar to him, like the white female buttocks he had seen in a dozen historical canvases. It occurred to him that likely they were the very same. Her neat-lipped cunt was furred with auburn hair. She smiled at his stare.
"Would you like to see me naked?"
"Very much."
"For a shilling?"
"All right."
She threw off her chemise with apparent relief, sweat standing out all over her. She sponged tenderly at her dripping armpits.
"I can stand in pose, not moving at all, for full 5 minutes at a time," she said, slurring a bit.
She had drunk nearly all of the champagne.
"Have you a watch? 10 shilling and I'll do it. Do you bet I can?"
"I'm sure you can do it," Mallory said.
Hetty bent gracefully, grasped her left ankle, and lifted it straight above her head, her leg stiff at the knee. She began spinning about slowly, shuffling on heel and toe.
"You like it?"
"Wonderful," Mallory said, stunned.
"Look, I can put both my hands quite flat on the floor," she said, bending at the waist. "Most London girls are so tight-laced they'd break in bloody half if they tried this."
Then she went into a split on the floor and gazed up at him, drunken and triumphant.
"I never lived till I came to London," Mallory said.
"Take off your shirt, then, and let's fuck Starkus."
Her long-jawed face was flushed, her grey eyes bulging. Mallory took his shirt off. She advanced on him with the enamel basin.
"Fucking naked's fine in beastly hot weather like this. I always like to fuck naked. My, you have fine firm flesh on you, and I do like a man with some hairiness. Let's have a look at your prick."
She grabbed it forthrightly, skinned it back and examined it, then dabbled it in the basin.
"You're not sick, dear. There's nothing wrong with you. It's quite a fine one. Why not fuck me without that nasty sausage skin and save yourself 9 pence?
9 pence isn't much," Mallory said.
He put on another French letter, then mounted her. He rutted nakedly, sweating like a blacksmith. The sweat was pouring off the both of them, with a reek of bad champagne, yet the sticky skin of her great teats felt quite cool against his naked chest. She galloped along under him, her eyes shut and her tongue showing at the corner of her crooked mouth, and put the backs of her heels sharply into his buttocks. At last he spent, groaning between clenched teeth at the burning rush through his prick. There was a roaring in his ears.
"You're a bawdy devil, my Ned, and sure."
Her neck and shoulders were red with prickly heat.
"So are you,"
Mallory gasped.
"I am, dear, and I like to do it with a man who knows how to treat a girl. Let's have some nice bottled ale, then. More cooling than that champagne."
"All right, fine.
And some Paparossi. Do you like Paparossi?"
"What are those, exactly?"
"Turkish cigarettos, from the Crimea. They're all the rage since the war."
"You smoke tobacco?"
Mallory asked, surprised.
"I learnt it from Gabrielle," she said, climbing from bed. "Gabrielle, she lived here after Sybil left. She was a Frenchie from Marseille. But she sailed to French Mexico last month with one of her embassy soldiers. She married him, lucky thing."
Hetty wrapped herself in a robe de nuit of yellow silk. In the lantern light it looked a fine garment, despite its frayed hems.
"Sweet she was, Gabrielle. Donnez-moi 4 shillings, dear. No, 5.
"Can you change a pound note?" Mallory said.
Hetty gave him 15 shillings, with a sour look, and vanished into the parlour. She was absent a long time, chatting with Mrs. Landlord, it seemed. Mallory lay at ease in her bed, listening to strange distant echoes of the great metropolis. Bells ringing, distant high-pitched cries, bangs that might be gunshots. He was as drunk as a lordship, it seemed, and lordship felt mortal fine. The weight would be back on his heart soon enough, and no doubt redoubled for the sin, but for the moment fleshly pleasure had lifted him, and he felt quite free and feather-light. Hetty returned with a wire crate of bottles in one hand, puffing a lit cigaretto with the other.
"You took a long time," he said.
She shrugged. "A bit of trouble downstairs. Some ruffians." She set the crate down, pulled a bottle out, and flung it to him.
"Feel how cool. They keep these in the cellar. Nice, ain't it?"
Mallory unloosed the complex stopper of porcelain cork and levered wire, and thirstily drank. "Newcastle Ale," the bottle said, in moulded letters of raised glass. A modern brewery where they made the liquor in great steel vats near the size of a ship of the line. Fine machine-made brew, free of any cheater's taint of jalap or Indian berry. Hetty got into the bed in her robe, drained the last of a bottle, and opened another.
"Take the robe off," Mallory said.
"You didn't give me my shilling."
"Here, then."
He slipped the coin under the mattress and smiled.
"You're a rum'un, Neddy. I like you."
She took the robe off, flung it at the iron coat hook on the back of the door. Missed.
"I'm in a rare mood tonight. Let's have another go."
"In a bit,"
Mallory said, and yawned. His lids felt heavy, suddenly, grainy. The back of his head throbbed where Velasco had smacked him. It seemed an age ago. It seemed an age since he had done anything but drink and rut. Hetty gripped his limp prick and began to fondle it.
"When did you last have a woman, Ned?"
"Ah, 2 months, I think. 3.
"And who was she?"
"She was..."
She had been a whore in Canada, but Mallory suddenly stopped.
"Why do you ask?"
"Tell me. I like to hear about it. I like to know what the fancy do."
"I don't know anything about that. Nor do you, I imagine."
Hetty released his prick and folded her arms. She leaned back against the headboard, then lit another papirosi, scraping her lucifer against a rough patch of plaster. She blew smoke through her oddly shaped nose, a disconcerting sight for Mallory.
"You don't think I know anything," she said.
"I've heard such things as you don't imagine, I'll wager."
"No doubt," Mallory said politely. He finished his ale.
"Did you know that old Lady Byron flogs her husband naked? His prick won't stand till she beats him on the arse with a German riding crop, and I that straight from a cover who was sweet on me, who had it from an upstairs servant in the household."
"Oh?
That Byron family is dead bawdy and wicked to the core. He's too old now, but in his younger days he'd fuck a sheep, Lord Byron would. He'd fuck a bush if he thought a sheep was in it. His wife's no better. She doesn't fuck other men, but she's of the flogging sisterhood."
"Remarkable," Mallory said. "What about their daughter, then?"
Hetty said nothing for a moment. He was surprised at the sudden gravity of her expression.
"She's dead flash, Ada is. She's the greatest whore in all of London."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because she fucks whoever she pleases, and none dare make a peep about what she does. She's at half the House of Lords, and they all tag at her skirts like little boys, and call themselves her favourites and her paladins, and if any man breaks troth and dares breathe a word against her, then the others see to it that he comes to a very bad end. They all ring round her and protect her and worship her like Romish priests do their Madonna."
Mallory grunted. It was horse talk, not a proper thing to say. He knew that Lady Ada had her gallants, but the thought that she let men have her, that there was shoving and spending, prick and cunt in the mathematical bed of the Queen of Engines. Best not to think about it. His head had a whiskey spin, somehow.
"Your expertise is impressive, Hetty," Mallory muttered. "You certainly command the data of your trade."
Hetty, who had been guzzling at another bottle of ale, laughed explosively. Foam splattered her chest.
"Oh, Christ," she said, coughing and smearing at her breasts. "Lord, Neddy, how you do talk! Look what you made me do."
"Sorry," Mallory said.
She gave him a fleering grin and picked her smouldering cigaretto from the edge of the bureau.
"Get the rag and give him a good wash," she suggested. "I'll bet you'd like that, eh?"
Without a word, Mallory stooped to his work. He fetched the basin and sopped the hand towel, scrubbing the wet terry carefully over her breasts and the fat, navel-dimpled white rise of her belly. Hetty watched with hooded eyes, puffing at her cigaretto and flicking ashes on the floor, as if her flesh belonged to someone else. After a while she silently gripped his prick, working it back and forth encouragingly as he wiped at her legs. Mallory put on another sheath, with some clumsy fumbling, almost losing his erection as he did so. To his relief he managed to enter her, where he soon regained stiffness in her welcoming flesh, and thumped hard at her, tired and drunk, with an ache in his arms and his wrists and his back, and a strange, painful tingling at the root of his prick. The glands felt quite sore, almost painfully tender within its sheep-gut armour, and to spend seemed as hard and tricky as pulling a rusty nail. The bedsprings creaked like a field of metal crickets. Halfway through, Mallory felt as if he had run for miles, and Hetty, whose dead cigaretto had burnt the bureau, seemed entranced, or perhaps only stunned, or drunk. For a moment he wondered if he should simply stop, quit, tell her somehow that it simply wasn't working, but he could not even begin to find the words that would satisfactorily explain this situation, so he soared on. His mind wandered to another woman, a cousin of his, a red-haired girl whom he had seen being shagged behind a Sussex hedgerow, when he had been up a tree as a boy hunting cuckoo's eggs. The red-haired cousin had married the man, and was 40 years old now, with grown children, a round little proper woman in a round little proper bonnet. But Mallory never met her without remembering the tortured look of pleasure on her freckled face. He clutched that secret image now like a galley slave to his oar, and fought his way stubbornly toward a climax. Finally there was that melting, cresting feeling in his loins that told him that he would, in fact, spend soon, that nothing would hold him back, and he shoved on with a new desperation, panting very hard, and the agonized rush of spending came up his aching spine like a rocket, a surge of shocking pleasure in his arms, in his legs, even in the naked soles of his cramping feet, and he cried out, a loud, ecstatic, bestial groan that surprised him.
"Lordy!" Hetty commented.
Mallory collapsed off of her and lay blowing like a beached cetacean in the fetid air. His muscles felt like rubber, and he'd half sweated the whiskey off with the sheer work of it. He felt utterly wonderful. He felt quite willing to die. If the tout had arrived and shot him on the spot, he would somehow have welcomed it. Welcomed the opportunity never to come back from that plateau of sensibility, the opportunity never to be Edward Mallory again, but only a splendid creature drowned in cunt and tea-rose. But after a moment the feeling was gone, and he was Mallory again. Too stupefied for any refinements of guilt or regret, Mallory nevertheless felt ready to leave. Some unspoken crisis had passed, and the episode was finished. He was simply too tired to move just yet, but he knew that he was about to. The whore's bedroom no longer felt like any kind of haven to him. The walls seemed unreal, mere mathematical abstractions, boundaries that could no longer restrain his momentum. "Let's sleep a bit," Hetty said, her words blurred with drink and exhaustion.
"All right."
He sensibly set the box of lucifers within convenient reach, turned out the lantern, and lay in the hot London dark like a suspended platonic soul. He rested, eyes open, a flea feasting with leisurely precision on his ankles. He did not sleep exactly, but rested for some indefinite time. When his mind began to run in circles, he lit and smoked one of Hetty's cigarettos, a pleasant ritual, though without much point as far as the proper use of tobacco went. Later he left the bed and pissed in the pot de chambre, by feel. Ale had spilled on the floor there, or perhaps it was something else. He would have liked to wipe his feet, but there seemed little point. He waited for something akin to dawn to show at Hetty's bare and grimy casement, which gazed out gloomily at a nearby wall. At length there came a feeble glow, not much at all like honest daylight. He had sobered now, and lay there parched, his head feeling stuffed with gun cotton. Not at all bad, really, if he didn't move it suddenly, but full of grim, premonitory throbs. He lit the bedside candle, found his shirt. Hetty woke with a groan and stared at him, her hair snarled and sweaty, her eyes bulging with a look that almost frightened him. Ellinge, they would have called it in Sussex. Fay.
"You're not going," she said.
"Yes."
"Why, it's so dark still."
"I prefer an early start," he paused. "An old camp habit."
Hetty snorted.
"Get back in bed, my brave soldier. Don't be silly. Stay a bit. We'll wash and have breakfast. You can get that, can't you? A nice big breakfast?"
"I'd rather not. It's late, I must go. I have business."
"How late?"
she yawned.
Not even dawn yet.
It's late. I'm certain of it.
What does Big Ben say?
I haven't heard Ben all night,
Mallory said, the recognition surprising him.
Government have shut it down, I suppose.
This bit of speculation seemed to vaguely alarm Hetty.
French breakfast, then, she suggested. Sent up from downstairs. Pastry, pot of coffee, it's cheap.
He shook his head. Hetty paused, narrowed her eyes. The refusal seemed to have startled her. She sat up, the bed creaking, and tugged at her disordered hair.
Don't go out. The weather's dreadful. If you can't sleep, dear, then let's fuck.
I don't think I can. I know you like me, Neddy.
She raised the sweat-dampened sheet.
Come on, feel me all over. That will make it stand.
She lay there waiting, with the sheet up. Mallory, unwilling to disappoint, came toward her, patted her lovely haunches, and groped about the luscious smoothness of her breasts. Her flesh delighted his touch, but his prick, though it stirred, did not stand.
"I really must go," he said.
"It will stand again if you wait a bit."
"I can't stay any more."
"I would not do this if you were not such a nice man," Hetty said slowly. "But I can make it stand right now, if you like. Connaissez-vous la belle Gamahouche?"
"What's that, then?"
"Well," she said, "if you'd been with Gabrielle instead of me, you'd have had it by now. She always did it with her men and said they were mad for it. It's what they call gamahouching, the French pleasure."
"I'm not sure I understand."
"Prick-sucking."
"Oh, that."
He had heard the term, though only as the foulest kind of abusive curse, and was startled to find himself in a situation where it might be performed as a physical act. He tugged at his beard.
"Ah, how much would that cost?"
"I wouldn't do it for any price, for some," she assured him. "But I do like you, Ned, and for you I'd do it."
"How much?"
She blinked.
10 shillings?
"Half a pound."
"I don't think so," he said.
"Well, all right, 5 shillings, if you don't finish there. But you have to promise that, and I mean it."
The implications of this proposal gave him an exquisite thrill of disgust.
"No, I don't care for that."
He began to dress.
"You'll come again, then? When will you see me?"
"Soon."
She sighed, knowing he was lying.
"Go, then, if you must. But listen, Neddy, I do know you like me. And I don't remember your proper name exactly, but I know I've seen your portrait in the papers. You're a famous savant, and you have a deal of tin. I'm right about that, aren't I?"
Mallory said nothing. She hurried on.
"A fellow like you can get in bad trouble with the wrong sort of London girl. But you're safe as houses with Hetty Edwards, for I only go with gentlemen, and I'm very discreet."
"I'm sure that you are," Mallory said, dressing hastily.
"I dance Tuesdays and Thursdays at the Pantoscopic Theatre down Haymarket. Will you come and see me?"
"If I'm in London."
He left her then, and felt his way out of the place. On his hasty way to the stairs, he bloodily scraped his shin on the pedal of someone's chained bicycle. The sky above the heart was like nothing Mallory had ever seen, yet he knew it. He had seen such a sky with his mind's eye, a lowering dome abrim with explosive filth, awash with obliterating dust, a sky that was the very harbinger of catastrophe. By the twilight blur of the fully risen sun, he reckoned it near 8 o'clock. Dawn had come, yet brought no day. The land leviathans had seen this very sky, he knew, after the earth-shaking shock of the great comet. For the scaly herds, ceaselessly progressing through the teeming jungles, driven always by a mighty hunger in their great fermenting bellies, this had been the sky of Armageddon. Storms of cataclysm lashed the Cretaceous earth, vast fires raged, and cometary grit sifted through the roiling atmosphere to blight and kill the wilting foliage, till the mighty dinosauria, adapted to a world now shattered, fell in massed extinction, and the leaping machineries of evolution were loosed in chaos to repopulate the stricken earth with strange new orders of being. He scuffed down Flower and Dean Street, awestruck, coughing. He could see little more than 30 feet ahead, for the alley roiled with a low-lying yellow fog that blurred his eyes with its clinging acid tang. More by luck than design, he emerged on Commercial Street, ordinarily a thriving Whitechapel Avenue, Deserted now, its smooth tarmac was spread with fountained shards of shop-front glass. He walked a block, then another. There was scarcely a window intact. Cobbles, grubbed up from side streets, had been flung right and left like a shower of meteors. A seeming whirlwind had descended on a nearby grocery, leaving the street ankle-deep in dirty snowdrifts of flour and sugar. Mallory picked his way through battered cabbages, squashed greengages, crushed jars of syrupped peaches, and the booted footballs of whole smoked hams. Scatterings of damp flour showed a stampede of men's brogues, the small bare feet of street urchins, the dainty trace of women's shoes, and the sweep of their skirt hems. Four mist-shrouded figures, three men and a woman, all dressed respectably, all carefully masked in thick cloth, came shuffling into view. Noticing him, they pointedly crossed the street. They moved slowly, unhurriedly, talking together in low tones. Mallory moved on, splintered glass crunching under his shoe heels. Myers' Gents Furnishings, Peterson's Haberdashery, LaGrange's Parisian Pneumatique Laundrette, all presented disintegrated storefronts and doors torn off their hinges. Their fronts had been thoroughly pelted with stones, with bricks, with raw eggs. Now a more cohesive group appeared, men and young boys, some rolling heaped barrows, though they were clearly not costers. In their masks they seemed tired, bemused, sombre, as though attending a funeral. In their aimless progress they slowed before a sacked cobbler's, picking over the scattered shoes with the limp enthusiasm of scavengers. Mallory realized that he had been a fool. While he had wallowed in mindless dissipation, London had become a locus of anarchy. He should be home in peaceful Sussex now, with the family. He should be readying for little Madeline's wedding, in clean country air, with his brothers and sisters at hand, with decent home-cooked food and decent homely drink. A sudden agony of homesickness struck him, and he wondered what chaotic amalgam of lust and ambition and circumstance had marooned him in this dreadful, vicious place. He wondered what the family were doing at that very moment. What was the time, exactly? With a jolt, Mallory remembered Madeline's clock. His sister's wedding gift was sitting in its brass-hasped carry-case in the safety box of the Palace of Paleontology. The lovely, fancy clock for dear Madeline, now grotesquely out of his reach. The palace was 7 miles from Whitechapel, 7 miles of roiling chaos. There must be some way back, some way to cross that distance, surely. Mallory wondered if any of the city's trains were running, or the omnibuses, perhaps a hansom. Horses would choke in this foul mist. He was down to Shanks's mare. Likely any effort to cross London was foolish, and likely it would be wisest to cower in some quiet cellar like a rat, hoping for catastrophe to pass him over. And yet Mallory found his shoulders squaring, his legs tramping forward of their own accord. Even the throbbing in his parched head began to pass as his wits focused on a goal, back to the palace, back to his life.